Welcome to the scorching arena of valor and the crucible of courage. This is the Forged in the Fires podcast with Fireman Rob. Here in the inferno of life's greatest challenges, heroes are shaped and legends are born. Every episode is a torchlight of wisdom, casting a glow on the paths walked by those who've braved the flames and emerged stronger. In this furnace of fortitude, we'll explore tales of resilience, bravery, and the unyielding human spirit. Each guest brings their own spark of insight, lighting up the darkness and guiding us through the smoke of adversity. With Fireman Rob at the helm, prepared to delve into conversations that smolder with significance and stories that kindle the soul. It's not just a podcast, it's a beacon for all who seek to rise from the ashes and glow with purpose. So stoke the fires of your curiosity and ready your heart for tales of triumph and transformation. The flames are roaring. The stage is ablaze. Welcome to the Forged in the Fires podcast. Let the journey begin.
All right, welcome back to Forged in the Fires podcast. I'm your host, Fireman Rob. Today's guest, oh man, this is going to be a fun one. Who knows how long it'll go. We were just talking about this. He is a fire captain in Los Angeles County Fire Department. He is a peer support advocate. He talks about mental health. He's been on the podcast of Trauma Behind the Badge. He's been on No One Fights Alone. He's the man, the myth, the legend, Ed Monroe. Thanks for being on today.
Oh my goodness, after a build up like that, we're going to let a lot of people down.
No. This is, I'm excited. This is going to be fun. I mean, the best part is, like, you know, having people understand how many different personalities there are in the fire service.
Right.
That's the great part, right?
Oh, absolutely. It's worse than that crazy girlfriend you had in high school. There's more personalities than that.
I love it. And one of the questions I always ask people, and this is one of my favorite answers that I've gotten, is, you know, what are the challenges in life? And you put all of it. I love it. Like parenting, all sorts of different things. I want to actually go back before you started in the fire service. Who was Ed Monroe growing up, and how did you choose to get into being a firefighter?
Growing up was kind of an adventure. My dad was a pilot in the Air Force, and I kind of lived all over the place. I went to 13 schools between first and 12th grade. So between his time in the service, and then, you know, my parents, they split up when I want to say just before fourth grade, and I lived with both of them over the years. So I had a pretty transitory life as a kid.
Wow. From that experience of, like, being able to go all over the place, what was some of the things that you learned as a young kid? I mean, that's got to be hard. There was no consistency.
But you know what? When you're a kid, you don't know any better.
Yeah.
I didn't know any better until I was probably in high school, and I'm listening to people I'm going to high school with talk about, oh, I've been to school with these guys for years, and when I was a kid, I just kind of, you know, it was time to move. It was time to move. I didn't know any better. So I just kept moving. Things I've learned. I learned that Okinawa is really hot and humid, and I never want to live in that kind of environment again. So you can have South Carolina all you want. And I'll stay where it's dry.
Yeah.
But, you know, one of the things I learned is that it's important to build relationships, and it's important to, no matter how long you're going to be somewhere, even if you think you're going to be there a long time, you might not be. Even if you don't think you're going to be somewhere very long, you just might be there forever. It's important to build relationships and make them genuine and be that authentic person to whoever it is you meet.
It kind of transitions well to being in a leadership spot. You know, now you're a fire captain. It kind of transitions into that where you'll get people in and out of your, you know, whether you're in hazmat or whether you're in structural wildland, you'll get different people in and out of that. How does that translate to your leadership style to have them understand how to be more comfortable with that change?
You know, I think for me, my thing is I want to be approachable and I want to hear what my guys think. Whether that's the guys on my fire engine now or, I even ran inmates doing fire crew supervisor work, doing wildland stuff. I wanted to hear what those guys thought. I mean, now I may not act on it, but I wanted to hear what they thought, because when there's 14 of us out there on the fire line, you know, they may see something I don't see, and that might be critical. So I would be an idiot to just discount anything that they say.
How does that, I know a lot of people probably like, you did what? You know, working with the inmates and as fire crews, that's pretty common. It's a standard thing, but it's something that is special for them to be able to do with good behavior, right?
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. And it's something they volunteer for. They're not forced into like this indentured servitude. But in my fire department, it's a job that engineers can try to get lined up in. And with Cal Fire, which is like a big state agency out here, that's a job that captains get lined up in. So it's really common out here to see wildland fire crews with guys wearing orange. I'm like, oh, those guys are all inmates. And you go out there. I remember the first time I told my wife, hey, I'm gonna go work in the camps, and I'm gonna run inmates. And she goes, oh, that's cool. She goes, is there any guards going with you? I'm all, no, not really. She goes, well, they give you a gun? I'm like, no.
Nope.
She goes, well, what do you do if they decide they're going to do something else? I'm like, I got a radio. She's like, I don't know.
Throw it at
them. Yeah, right? But it was great work. And these guys, they wanted, I mean, for the most part, it's a win-win for them. They're not in a big formal prison. They're in a fire camp. And for them, that's work that's different. It's time that's different. And the food tends to be better. And we go out and do stuff every day. It's a different way to spend your time. It's super hard work.
Oh, absolutely. My gosh, yes.
But it's interesting to them. They learn something and they work with, as a team. And some of these guys, it changes their lives. Not very many of them, but some of them.
When you're doing wildland, I think this is one of the most interesting things. Like, I've been a structural guy for my whole career. Wildland's a different beast. Like, what does it take to be able to do wildland? Because it's sheer endurance and sheer will, and you are at the beckon of the weather. What does it take?
Well, I think I have the answer for you, and you're going to understand it just based on your Ironman experience. Embrace the suck. It's hard work, especially on a fire.
So true.
And you're going to go up these impossibly steep hills, and you're going to be cutting fire line, and you're going to be tired, and you might be working a 24-hour shift, or you might be initial action on a fire like I was on a huge fire right here. We were initial action. We put in 36 hours, and we were fought fire for 36 hours, and we were exhausted. But you just embraced it. At the end of it, you're like, hey, you know what? We saved these horses from dying. Nobody's ever going to know which horses they were. And not even the owners knew. They just knew they came home like, oh, our horses are fine. They didn't know there was a group of inmates that kept them alive.
But
it's a great job, and it's rewarding.
Yeah, 36 hours, I mean. And then were you guys hiking in, hiking out?
Yeah, so you hike in. Sometimes you'll drive in. So we had a crew bus. You know, I'd drive us to where it is we're going to put the bus, and we'd hike into where we're going to go do work. And we'd coordinate with our strike team leader or our superintendent, and we'd make a plan and we'd go to work.
What are some of the things that you had to, because I'm sure there has to be certain individuals that'll get to a certain point where they go, you know, screw this. This is way too much. As a leader, what does that functionality look like when somebody gets like that? Because there's nothing else for them to do but just keep working.
Well, if they're getting to that point, I'm probably getting to that point. And it's a come on, man. We're there.
True.
We're going to take a break. And but we're gonna get up and we're gonna go back to work because you know what every other guy here is gonna get up and go back to work. And you don't normally have problems like that with these guys because you've trained them enough and you've been out with them enough and everybody knows each other enough to like, all right, I know that Monroe's looking out for us, he's gonna keep us in a decent spot, and at the
Right.
same time he counts on us to do our job. And it actually works out a lot better than you would think.
Yeah. I mean, when throughout your career, what would you say? I want to pick on one, just one event, but what would you say one critical event that happened in your career? It can be anywhere in your career that you really noticed yourself either growing or changing trajectory in the mindset that you had in the fire service.
Well, for me, and it's the whole reason I even has probably what brought me to you. I mean, for me, that event would be in my department. It's the Sierra incident, and in that event, I'll try to keep it short. But
No, you're fine.
in that event, one of our guys at the next fire station up the road from me. So the guy I'd known for 6 years, and he and I used to work together. He went into the fire station. He shot and killed one of his opposites, and then he shot the fire captain. And then he went home, burned down his house, and killed himself. And I was on that
Jeez.
call. The paramedic at that fire station called me as it was happening. And he's like, "Monroe, it's Sparky, because I'm not fucking around. Two-Tone just came
Yeah.
in here. He shot and killed Tori. He shot Arnie. I need help." And that's how it started for me. You know, and
Jeez.
prior to that incident, you know, I was never like a mental health guy. I wasn't a peer support guy. I was a
Yeah.
guy who thought dimly on guys who took their own lives and struggled. I
Yeah.
thought they were just being weak. And coming away from going through that call and everything I did there and coming away from it, I 100% have changed all of my thinking on that. Now I'm passionate about wanting to help guys, and because I know the pit I was in coming away from that
Yeah.
and still struggle with. I mean, it's only been 2.5 years, but if I can help somebody not feel the way I felt, because I felt terrible, then I want to do that. It's absolutely
That's,
changed my life.
and it's crazy. Like, I love that you mentioned that first part because I think it's so powerful for an individual of your stature, of your time in service to be able to say that, I thought the same way of people who took their own lives. I thought the same way of like mental health before this. I mean, yeah, come on, just suck it up and move on. It's such a ingrained culture in the fire service that, do you think that there's a change that's going to happen, or is it just that there's certain people that will awaken to that philosophy that, yeah, it's okay, it's your life.
You know what? You were just on Trauma Behind the Badge with those guys, and they made this
Yeah.
great point about the stigma and all this stuff. And they were saying how, yeah, we got the stigma, but we have the stigma because we're the ones who made it. And now it's up to us to
True.
fix it. And
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it's like, no, to say it's like leave it to a fireman to ruin a good deal. I mean, it's just like it's the best
Yeah.
example of how we are our own worst enemies at times.
Oh, by far. By far. And it's interesting because, we have a sign at one of our stations that says 150 years of tradition unimpeded by progress.
Right.
And it's so true, isn't
It's
it?
absolutely true. And some of our traditions are great, but man,
Yeah.
we have some really bad traditions that need to stop.
Yeah. And those traditions, like when you're in a leadership role like yourself, how hard is it to actually verbalize that change that you see should happen?
You know, it depends on what it is, but ultimately, I try and tell guys that are working for me, whether on my crew or it's overtime, say, "Hey, man, we're just trying to do the right thing. Whether we're trying to help a patient or help somebody's dog or just, you know, run a fire, let's just do the right thing, you guys. That's what it comes down to."
Right. And it's hard because you look at that situation that you had to go through, and do you feel when you're looking at mental health And, you know, I always have the feeling that you're always going to live with those circumstances, those things in your head. It's just how you help yourself to progress every single day. How did you start that journey? Because obviously you said, like before, you said, I didn't believe in that stuff. That was, I thought they were cowards when they did that. How did you even start that journey for yourself to be here going, hey, I want to help somebody?
Well, initially, especially after the call, I mean, I went through that and I knew what I went through. Even 24 hours later was, oh, I'm going to have a hard time now. I could feel it. And, you know, I went home after that and I, you know, I had the wherewithal to tell my wife, I was like, hey, don't let me sit in our room and let me stare at the walls because that may not be a good idea. And she did really well trying to get me out and stuff. But, I was rapidly became non-functioning at work and I had to take, I took some time off on stress and I started talking to a therapist and had some therapy there. And I still talk to that therapist to this day. It's been 2.5 years now I've been talking to her. And I find when I don't talk to her, I kind of spin out. So I keep talking to her, talk to her a couple times a month.
What does it mean when you have those moments with the therapist? Like, cause I know that I went through a bunch of them. I found the one that I needed.
You know, I got lucky in the very first, I shouldn't say very first. I talked to a couple people prior, just briefly, but they weren't even setting up to be like my long-term therapist. They're just people I spoke to in the interim. But the first time I went into her office, and it's funny because she's older than me. She's in her 70s. And I saw her as a little short woman. And I'm like, and my first thought was, oh my God, there's no way I'm going to relate with this woman. And I sit down in her office and I'll see how this goes. And she goes, hi, Ed. It's good to meet you. Let me tell you a little bit about myself. She goes, my husband came back from Vietnam and he was different. And I wanted to understand why. And that's what got me into this line of work. And she spoke to me about how she talks to cops and firemen and vets and military guys and guards and all this stuff and how she has just like pursued that over the years. And I'm like, all right, maybe she knows a couple things. And she's been like a great sounding board, you know, you know, I was in the fire service. I mean, you're like, you know, maybe we should listen to that guy. He's been around. He might know a couple things. Yeah.
Exactly. Exactly.
But it worked out. I was really fortunate.
That's great that you, I mean, all the things that you're saying are things that I went through as well. I mean, it's funny because we all feel like we're on an island when we do this. And it's not really an island, is it? Everybody kind of has that similar feel of story of when I go to the therapist, like there's no way this person can relate to me. And then you finally kind of open up. What did it feel like the first time you opened up about what you were feeling to that therapist?
Well, I opened up and back then whenever I opened up, which was, you know, I have no qualms about opening up. I'll talk about what I went through back then. And even to this day, I'll talk about all the time. Back then, as soon as I opened up, I would just start crying. And I have tears flowing. I'm talking to her, and I got tears coming down my face. She's like, all right, so we're going to try this. Like, we did EMDR. So I'm an advocate for EMDR for people who are thinking about that. It worked for me. Obviously, it's different for everybody. But you know what? It was really good. She helped me be able to talk about it without completely just coming unhinged. You know, it's back to work in under a month. Which was a good thing.
Oh, wow.
You know, I'm at work now, but now at the same time, yeah, I'm working and I'm doing things. I still have a hard time with emotional detachment. And in my opinion, I'm not the best husband in the world. And I'm still trying to be a decent father, but I'm probably not doing an awesome job at that either. And, but you know, I'm trying, I'm making an effort. It's just all stuff that's really, really difficult because you've gone through this thing and you're different. And I heard this somewhere too. You were there talking about this, how you're a different person now. And I used to tell my therapist, hey, I just want to be fixed. I want to be back to the way I was.
Oh my God.
And she's like, Ed, you don't get to be fixed. You're a different person. You have different strengths, different weaknesses now. You got to figure out who you are moving forward. That's been the biggest challenge for me, is figuring out who I am now and moving forward, and how that looks, how I'm going to look, what I want to do, what's going to motivate me. So that's what's been difficult.
And do you notice that, like, as you start to get better and as you start to gain traction in who you are, that sometimes those tools that you were using aren't functional anymore to be able to be who you are?
Yeah, sometimes. Sometimes it's like that. Like even lately, you know, some of the tools that you use is you try to put up certain walls so you don't feel certain things, and which is not a great, a healthy thing to do. But you're doing that because you feel so overloaded, and you're trying to shelter yourself from a certain pain and shelter people around you from that pain. And now I'm like, all right, I've got to tear some of these down. I've kind of got to let people in, and it's difficult. It's challenging. I want to say, you dealt with stuff for 10 years coming away from 9/11, and
yeah,
you know, I'm 2.5 years into this, and I am by no means close to the end, I think.
Yeah.
I think I'm better than I was, but I still think it's extremely difficult, and I don't wish it on anybody.
And that's the hardest thing, but I love that you're able to talk about it, because I think it's so powerful and so impactful for individuals like yourself to be able to do that, because young firefighters that are coming up, old crotchety ones like myself, we need to have our brains open up every once in a while. I didn't say you. but it is so true. So when you started out, I want you to go back to when you started out on LA County. What was it like when you first started out in the stations? Like, how did you start to progress through becoming that fireman that you wanted to become? Was it right away, or was there a lot of challenges when you started?
You know what? It was both. When I started, I was super, super green. I didn't have hardly any experience that's significant. It was all super, super minor. So I get hired by LA County, and LA County is a massive department. We have 3,000 badged personnel, like over 170 fire stations. So you're in a place where, like, I'm guys I graduated from the tower with, I haven't seen them since I've graduated.
Seriously.
So, but you go out there, it's like, it's that bad. It's that big. And then, you know, like, I started the fire stations, and I'm just trying to be a sponge. I'm trying to take it all in. And I tell new guys now, you guys have got to be a sponge. And just listen now, you know, like my old kids explain, yeah, but you know what? We want to have voices and we have opinions and blah, blah, blah. And I'm trying to understand there's a generational difference there now, right?
Yeah, a little bit.
My kids are the age of the people we're hiring. And so I'm trying to make sure I understand that, be sensitive to that to a certain respect. But at the same time, I'm like, hey, kid, you need to listen.
So true. So true. Now, did you all? So, I was looking at, so you got a degree. This is great. Uh-huh. You got a BS, and it's not bullshit. You got a BS in applied mathematics, and now you do mathematical analysis of the effectiveness of pre-positioned resources during fire weather. Talk to me more about that. Because
you know what? My role in that was not huge, right? So we had this department-wide thing. We were working with the Naval Postgraduate Institute, I think it was called. And they had a student there, a master's candidate, who was doing this project on the positioning of our resources during fire weather when we have high heat and high winds and low humidity. Because we would put stuff around LA County to pre-position it for fires. And my background, like, Ed's a math guy. He can help out. So, like, I didn't even do any of the heavy lifting on it. The naval student did all the heavy lifting on it. I just helped find data that I thought would be useful and maybe gave her things to think about when she had questions like, well, what's going to work? Why do you do X, Y, Z? And I would give her my thoughts. And there were a number of us in the department that would offer her, like, why we did things a certain way. And when she was formulating her thoughts in her thesis paper, She was able to address those.
And I bring that up because I think it's interesting from the standpoint of, you know, you've been in the fire service long enough. The amount of stuff that we do, the amount of, I guess, research and analysis that we do on fires and scenes and all this other stuff, how much of that is actually correlated to what you're now do a lot of stuff with is that mental health, that stress management. You know, do we have or have you seen a shift in, you know, having that, in essence, that pre-positioned resources for when we have those kind of incidents?
Well, I think, okay, in my department, we have a fairly large peer support group. We have over 200 peers in our peer
support. Wow, that's awesome.
Now, that being said, I think that we have limited effectiveness because, you know, I mean, guys on the job need to engage in their own recovery and wanting to deal with whatever it is that's eating at them, whether it's from an incident or whether it's from home or whether it's financial or whether it's career oriented or whatever it is. And some guys like, well, I'll talk to a peer and they think that that's going to fix everything. Well, peers aren't licensed therapists. You know, and I've told guys,
jackasses. You know, maybe,
yeah, right? Like, hey, man, let's go get a beer. Like, is that a great idea? Like, I don't know if it's a great idea, but we're going to go get a beer anyway. You know, it's tough. And then you tell these guys, hey, man, look, I can't offer you a ton of, like, really solid mental health advice, but let's get you hooked in with find you a therapist and stuff. And you know, guys clamp on the brakes at that point a lot of times. And there's a whole lot of apprehension on doing that. Even before I talked to a therapist, I talked to a couple of guys in my department who were involved in other significant incidents and said, hey, how'd you guys manage this? And they told me straight out, Ed, best thing I ever did was talk to a professional. And, you know, I got that from two different guys. And that if I hadn't heard that from them, I probably wouldn't have sought out a therapist.
That's interesting. That's interesting because it's...
And California's pretty progressive in this, and I still think we have a long way to go.
Oh, there's... Do you think... And this is something that I always thought is, like, I think that there's almost a fear of uncovering so much crap that we don't know about in the mental health of first responders that... It's almost like we're just kind of slowly peeling back this tarp of you know, shit that's underneath there.
Right. Well, when you peel it back, people don't want to see that. Yeah, guys struggle with, you know, alcohol abuse and broken relationships. And, you know, heaven forbid I say that maybe guys are struggling with drug abuse. I don't want to say that everybody in the world is struggling with that. But guys do. When you find these guys, you run into them like, hey, man, let's keep you some help. Just be honest about what's eating at you. And, man, that's hard. That's hard for the guy. It's hard for the leadership in the department. It takes a lot of just wanting to be honest with themselves and being intellectually honest about what's happening to get these issues addressed.
Yeah. And that's, and you know that I know that for many years, it was that fear of the punitive. Like if I'm nuts, then I'm done with my job. People can't trust me. Do you see that as much anymore?
I don't know. I worry about it with mine. You know, I'll go to the doc and I'm like, well, if he says I'm nuts, so to speak, like you just said.
Right.
Then what happens?
Yeah. Right.
But I had to tell myself that my mental health was a little bit more important than a given career field. And for some reason it didn't work out. I'd have to move on to something else. But you know, thankfully that hasn't happened. I still really love what I do. I still think my department that is a great department. It's just, you know, I've got challenges, but then so does everybody else in the department. I'm not unique in that.
Yeah. But it's so, I mean, I feel the same way. Like what you were saying is that underlying fear of like, yeah, I'm verbalizing now and I'm talking to people, trying to help other people. But at what point are they going to say, well, maybe you're too damaged to be here? How do we get past that? I mean, how do you have any ideas? Because that's a tough one, especially in our career field and in the military as well.
I think it's a matter of just facing it head on. I think that we have a whole lot of fear of what if, and we say, well, what if they say I can't work? What if they say I'm too damaged? What if, well, that's a whole bunch of, we can, what if everything until the sun goes dark?
Yeah.
How about we just address it and we move forward from there? I just think that we need to face it like we face any other emergency or a critical thing or whatever, you know?
That's so true. I think it's, you know, it's one of those things where when you look at it from a perspective of, and it's nice. Have you seen since you've been in a captain position and being an LA County firefighter is like, that's a top level. I mean, I would say it's above, you know, FDNY, but I know I'm going to get a lot of shit from that. But anyways,
they have a lot of those guys in that department. I'm not prepared to go rumble with them.
That's a lot of them. Maybe that's the next show. You could have a little UFC MMA match, you know, whatever.
There you go.
But what is the next iteration for you, Ed? Like, what do you see in the next like 5 years for yourself to be able to not only heal yourself, but or not heal yourself, I should say, to get better, to be able to live with what you went through, but at the same time, contribute to the fire service more?
For me, in the next 5 years, 5 years from now, I'll probably be retired from the fire department.
That's a great day.
I kind of see that happening. That'll put me at about 57 years old at that point. And I don't want to be much older than that as a fireman. The job is just hard. And to, you know, physically, I'm starting to get a little bit beat up on that. But, you know, coming away from retiring, I really want to, speak to groups of people. And if I can speak to a group of 1,000 people, put 999 of them to sleep and help one guy, then that's what I want to do.
That's my favorite right there. That's my favorite.
That's it. I think that's what I'm going to do moving forward. I've talked with my, various people. I've talked to my family about doing that. And I've talked with guys I work with about doing that. To me, it's important. I know how I felt, and I know how I felt listening to other people talk about their experiences and how that's helped me to know I'm not alone down the bottom of this pit. And you know what? If I can help somebody feel like they're not alone, that there's a light, there's hope, and there's somebody down there with me, then that's what I want to do.
That's huge. That's huge. Now, are you going to stay out in California? Are you going to go to like Tahiti or something? What are you thinking when you retire?
I would like to go to Tahiti, but I do I work here in Southern California. Tahiti would be nice, but it's a little bit remote. I happen to live in Idaho. So
you live in Idaho?
Back and forth doing that. Yeah. So I commute and I juggle my shifts around and I make that work.
Wow. That's awesome. Where do you live in Idaho?
So, I live in the Boise area. I live in Meridian.
Okay.
And it's nice. It's seasonal. I've been going to watch minor league hockey games. So now I'm going to think about you and your old Buzzards League out there.
Oh, I love it. I love it. Are you a big hiker? Does that give you any solace or
I've gotten into fly fishing up there.
Really?
There's a lot of rivers up there, and I've never really fly fished before. My brother-in-law got me into it. After the incident I went through, he took me out there. And I'm not good at it at all. I've never even landed a fish, but I really do like standing out there in the river and working the line and looking at the wildlife walk by. And it's super therapeutic and peaceful.
What is that? Because that's one of the biggest things. Like for me, it was doing those Ironman triathlons, which doesn't make sense. But that therapy, that feeling when you find something that you can attach to that kind of gives you that peace for a second. What does that feel like? Because I think there's a lot of people looking for it, but they don't know kind of what it will feel like or how to even find it.
You know what? You find it accidentally. Like I was listening to you talk about your Ironman. It's like, dude, that would be so much fun. And I just haven't done it. Like, I've done some Spartan races, which have been challenging, and I've had a good time with those. But to answer your question, when I was out there fly fishing, all of a sudden you feel like everything in the world just kind of stops. You're like, oh wait, there it is. And you realize that, you know what, stuff will be okay. You just have to let it be okay.
That's huge. That's such a huge thing. I love that statement. Where can people find you, Ed, to be able to have you speak?
Well, I'm on LinkedIn. I'm pretty sure I'm the only Ed Monroe with LA County Fire Department on LinkedIn.
Let me search.
Yeah, right? And but you know, my email address is monroe.fire.speaker@gmail.com. And I would love to help people and speak to with a small group of five or a large group of, you know, 500, no big deals. I've spoke to all sizes of groups.
I love it. Ed, thank you so much for being transparent. I love being able to have individuals that speak their mind and don't just try to accommodate the audience, but really provide a lot of value. But I can't leave you yet, Ed, because I have three questions for you. Are you ready?
Yeah.
All right. First question for you. If you could go back to your 18-year-old self and give yourself one piece of advice, what would that be?
Finish college in the first 4 years, not over the next 18 years.
Nice. The Tommy boy.
Yeah.
A lot of people go to school for 10 years.
Oh, man. I definitely took the hard road in school, let's put it that way.
I love it. All right. Here's the second one. Everybody's having challenges and struggles in their lives. If you could give them two habits to incorporate into their daily life to continue to move forward, to push forward, what would those two things be?
I would say eat breakfast. It's just a good way to start your day. And the other one, read a book once every month or two.
Love it. This last one's going to be fun. I have no idea who you'll choose. If you could pick three people that can be deceased or alive to have coffee with at a firehouse table, in other words, you know, anything is not off the table for conversation, who would those three people be and why would you choose them?
I would say probably Walt Disney would be one of them.
Ooh, that's a good one.
Because I think he was quite visionary in a whole lot of things, from how he saw families to entertainment to a lot of other things.
Yes.
I think just because I like football, I think it'd be super interesting to have Vince Lombardi there to talk.
I love that. Go in the Packers.
I couldn't imagine that. And then just because we need to have at least one smart guy there, I'd like to have Nikola Tesla there. The real Tesla, not the car Tesla.
Not an EV.
Not the car Tesla, no. But this is the guy that's responsible for electricity, and probably the most important invention in the modern era was alternating current. It'd be interesting to have him there.
Jeez, now that's a good table. You did good, Ed. I'm proud of you.
Thanks, man.
Well, I love it. Well, Ed, thanks so much for joining me today. I appreciate everything that you're doing. Keep on that journey and keep doing what you're doing.
Rob, no problem, buddy. And it was great being here. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening and supporting the Forged in the Fires podcast with Fireman Rob. Remember, don't forget to like and subscribe to this podcast. And please share this episode with a friend or family member. To find out more about Fireman Rob, or if you have a question, go to www.firemanrob.com. Until next time, live your life forged in the fires.